Beer. That's it. That's the tease. Well, beer and ending systemic economic racism, too. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Monday, today, the 24th day of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Well, it's official. Donald Trump is the Republican Party's nominee for president this year. Happened this morning at the GOP convention in Charlotte, the traditional roll call of states. Not a surprise, of course. What was something of a surprise, though, was the campaign's release of what it calls its core priorities for a second Trump term. A lot of economy stuff on there, a big infrastructure plan, more trade deals, also bringing manufacturing jobs, a million of them, back from China. In fact, there is a whole category headed ending our reliance on China. And that struck us because didn't we just sign that partial trade deal with Beijing back in January? Spoiler alert, we did. But as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genza reports, it is running a tad behind.
Back in January, President Trump signed a partial trade deal with China, known as Phase One. The U.S. eased up on tariffs, and Beijing promised to increase purchases of U.S. products by at least $200 billion by the end of 2021. Mary Lovely of the Peterson Institute for International Economics says China still has a long way to go.
China has bought about a quarter of what would be expected this year if they were going to meet these targets by December 2021.
The Chinese economy got walloped by the coronavirus, but also,
quite honestly, I never expected China to meet the goals that were laid out in the agreement.
Lynn Fisher Fox is a partner at the law firm Arnold and Porter.
I figured they had a 2-year timeline to do it because no one ever thought they were going to meet those goals.
If the goals aren't met, U.S. tariffs snap back. But China is making some progress on another part of the Phase One agreement, passing some intellectual property laws. But there was supposed to be a Phase Two deal tackling the really big issues like cyber theft and Beijing subsidies for Chinese companies. Wendy Cutler, vice president of the Asia Society Policy Institute, says those negotiations never started.
And now what we hear from both sides is that either a lack of interest, a lack of trust, but no definitive date for when those negotiations might commence.
And a check-in meeting between Washington and Beijing set for earlier this month to see how Phase One is going, canceled. I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
It's been just a little bit more than 2 weeks since President Trump signed a bunch of executive memoranda as all that emergency support for the economy dried up. The expiration of the extra $600 a week in unemployment benefits was the big one, and one of the president's memos was supposed to get the government back in that business, topping up unemployment benefits to the tune of $400 a week. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman looked into how that's going.
Right now, only two states, Arizona and Texas, are paying the new benefit the president promised, or at least part of it. They're paying $300 of the $400 a week Trump called for. Michelle Evermore at the National Employment Law Project says most states have applied to participate.
So it looks like states are trying to get this money out the door. But for the most part, I think it's going to take states quite a while to get this up and running.
States have to set up new online application systems and find new funding for the $100 a week that's their responsibility. But so far, only Kentucky, West Virginia, and Montana plan to pony up. So in most states, recipients would get a $300 a week top-up. Michael Strain at the American Enterprise Institute says that wouldn't be so bad, assuming the money goes out soon. He says the original $600 payment was more than many people earned while working.
There's very good reason to believe that continuing unemployment benefits that are that generous would keep people out of the workforce.
The expiration of the $600 benefit means consumers have had about $70 billion less in their pockets since the end of July. Mark Hamrick at Bankrate.com says that means
the economy will not be rebounding to the same extent as it would have otherwise. And we know that this rebound is quite precarious.
Oh, and one more potential glitch here. The money for the president's new program comes from FEMA's disaster funding, with wildfires ravaging California and two big storms heading for the Gulf Coast. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, airline stocks had a good session. Why, you ask? Well, because of the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act, of course. The Environmental Protection Agency said today it's going to give the state of Texas a waiver to said act so that Dallas-based American Airlines can use a new surface disinfectant which kills coronavirus for up to 7 days on the interiors of its airplanes. That obviously would be a big deal. American shares up better than 10% today. Other airlines followed suit. The other stock story on this Monday, Apple. Record highs all over the place. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We spent a lot of time on the show the past couple of months talking about the racism that is systemic in this economy and how to make it less systemic. And that, in a roundabout kind of way, is how I found myself in Inglewood, California a couple of weeks ago, L.A. adjacent, right out by the airport, talking beer.
What's up, man?
Same, same, pal. Just hanging out. You?
Hello, Benny.
Hi. How are you?
Hi. Nice to meet you.
That's T.O. Hunter and Benny Ashburn, co-founders of Crowns and Hops Brewing, soon to be the proprietors of the first black-owned brewery and taproom in Inglewood, T.O.'s hometown.
You're going to hear a lot of planes.
All right.
Some music.
That's why we're here. I mean, we could have done this on the phone or on right. Zoom, you know, but yeah, it would have just been boring. Inglewood. Bringing more black people into the world of craft beer became T.O. and Benny's mission after they met on Tinder a while ago, going on dates to taprooms and realizing they were usually the only black people there. The relationship didn't last, but their partnership did.
1-2-1-2, check 1-2.
Hello.
One, two.
Hello. Hello.
So first thing we have to do is I need you guys to introduce yourselves. Tell me who you are and what we're doing here.
Yes, my name is T.O. Hunter. I'm the head of brewing operations and COO for Crowns and Hops Brewing Company.
Hello, my name is Benny Ashburn. I'm the CEO of Crowns and Hops Brewing Company.
How did you guys decide who gets to be CEO and who gets to be COO?
She did.
I mean, kind of. My skill set, just what I've done in business, lends itself more to sort of that organization behind the scenes, keep things moving kind of pace. And Tio really is the heart and soul and the beer of the brand. So, you know.
Yeah, without a doubt, she is the momentum. I think, again, to the point of her background, and just I think the fact that not that many people in craft beer have seen such a strong black woman lead,
yeah.
It just made for a perfect opportunity not only to highlight what she's always done, but what, you know, she'll continue to do, yeah, in this industry.
We have to say here that, I mean, the reason we're here is that not too many people in craft brewing have seen strong black people, full stop.
Yeah.
Right? That's,
yeah,
that's why you're doing what you're doing.
Yes, 100%.
Say more.
I mean, this is about, for us, and what we've been able to really dial in on is this absolutely is about racial equity. You know, I think in a craft beer industry with over 7,500 breweries, you know, less than 1% are black owned.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of what we did initially was just fighting to ensure that our reflection was present in breweries that were, for the most part, located in black and brown neighborhoods. And, you know, as we continued our journey, we realized that there was another opportunity, which was to become owners in the space.
I want to talk about that location thing, because you guys are deliberate about wanting to be in Inglewood for people who live in Inglewood.
Yes.
Not the way it usually works is that craft brews go to a distressed place or an underserved place and white people come. That's
black,
not the point,
or brown,
right?
Places.
Black or brown places,
yeah.
Right. Yeah, no, 100%. Yeah. I think the great thing about Inglewood is it's still right now, you still feel the culture of what Inglewood has always been, which has been a very brown and black community. And I think coming here specifically as Inglewood is changing, we wanted to come back in and buy back the block, so they say. That's sort of the term that they're using.
And Nipsey Hussle,
and represent the culture that is here, and show faces, show owners, speaking to racial equity, like Tio right. mentioned, and really just be here to represent for us.
Has your mission and your purpose changed in this moment?
No.
I don't think so. Not at all.
If anything, it's been solidified.
Absolutely.
I think a lot of people, even when COVID hit, mm-hmm. Asked, well, how are you going to keep your community together? Well, we started our community online. Mm-hmm. You have to envision how difficult it might be for someone who has to walk into a space and be the only one. We were able to cultivate that community and truly nourish it online, mm-hmm. So when everything shut down, our community was there as they've always been. And if anything, again, when George Floyd was murdered, there became this message of amplifying the Black voice. Mm-hmm. And we also saw that as amplifying Black initiatives, Black business. And we have been building, over the course of the past 6 years, an opportunity to have our voice amplified.
Yeah, to Tio's point, when we first started this, we knew we couldn't start with just product. Our goal was to find the community, build the community, and to Tio's point, amplify Black voices in the craft beer community. We were not the first Black-owned brewery, but I think we were the first to possibly be the loudest and to galvanize a community in a way that had never been done before. And that mission hasn't changed because now we're actually going to open up those physical spaces and the community is now built and ready to go. So we're really excited about that.
You're counting also on Black money. You want Black funders for this. Why?
I think it was important to, as part of what Tio was saying, create that ecosystem of Black ownership, Black investors, Black money, and buying back into your community.
I mean, let's be honest, there's a ton of white equity holders.
Yeah.
We thought that it would be incredible to make sure that equity stay within Black families, Black owners. I do think there is a common theme with regards to specifically owners that are from this area, from the Southern California. I was born in Sentinella Hospital right around the corner. To ensure that ownership stays in that community is also, confirmation that the money will return and be circulated in that community versus it being taken to an area that the investors or equity stakeholders might not live in. That is the thing.
The thing we haven't talked about, why beer?
Because it's delicious.
Look, you're talking to a convert here. Now, you don't have to sell me. Anybody listening to this program knows that. What was it that made beer the thing that gave you guys this mission? That's the thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, well, think about it. Beer is an affordable luxury.
Yeah.
I've had beers with the janitor and the driver of the Mars rover in the same room. And when you have a beverage or a product that can strip down all of the pretentiousness, all of the BS that you might deal with in your respective life, family, whatever the case, and have this moment to where you can celebrate life and the things that make you happy. I don't know. That's like a super good PSA for beer, right?
It is a good PSA for beer.
But I mean, it's phenomenal. And again, what we didn't see was the contribution of people of color in craft beer. If you think about this thing being one of the oldest beverages on the planet.
You bet.
I just found out, about a year ago that my great-great-great-grandmother, three, right?
Yes,
three. Yeah, was a brewer. It's these stories that we don't know of. Why beer? Because we think that there's a huge opportunity for Black culture, for brown culture to be represented in it.
Yep.
And it stands the test of time. And it's delicious.
Thanks, you two. Thanks a lot. I really appreciate it. Best of luck with this whole thing. I think it's cool.
Thank you.
We're really excited. That was Tio Hunter, COO and head of brewing, and Benny Ashburn, CEO of Crowns and Hobbs Brewing Company, taking on an industry where, according to the latest data, 89% of brewers are white. We did an hour-long special about the racial wealth gap in this economy and how to create something that works for everybody. It is airing on some local public radio stations, and you can hear it always online, marketplace.org. Check out the Economy What Now page. We'll be right back. Coming up.
Bug spray and fine dining do not go together.
To be fair, though, bug spray is kind of the seasonal flavor of outdoor summer dining, right? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 378 points today, 1.3%, finished at 28,308. The NASDAQ picked up 67, 0.6%, 11,379. Another record high, by the way, for the S&P 500 coming right here. Added 34 points, 1%, 34.31. Apple, popular today because today is the day of record for a 4-to-1 stock split that takes effect at the end of the month, up 1.2% were Apple shares. Energy companies took workers from more than 100 oil and gas production platforms in the Gulf of Mexico over the weekend in advance of those tropical storms and hurricanes eventually. Interior Department says Gulf oil production is down 58%, natural gas production down 45% as a result. At the pump, gas prices nationwide, about $2.18 a gallon for regular. That's from AAA. 1 cent more than the average a week ago, about the same as a month ago. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. As you just heard, and as has been the case for a number of months now, it has been quite the run on Wall Street. The broad S&P 500 index, another record today. But as we have also told you again for a couple of months now, tens of millions of Americans have been laid off or furloughed or are just squeaking by. Not to get all Dickensian on you here, but there is a little bit of the best of times, the worst of times going on, largely because, as Marketplace's Scott Tong reports, the stock market is increasingly becoming the province of the very wealthy.
3 decades ago, the wealthiest 10% of Americans owned 79% of stocks and mutual funds in the market. Now they own 87%, according to the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis. Economist Edward Wolfe at NYU says a big reason many middle-class families have been left out is their money is locked up in their homes.
Since middle-class incomes have been pretty stagnant over the last 20 years or so, once people pay for their home, they don't really have much money left to buy other assets.
There have been efforts to broaden stock ownership, say through 401k accounts at work. Still,
the amounts of money invested are still pretty small.
This divide in stock ownership has widened since the Great Recession. During market drops, the wealthy have stayed in while many others have sold. Middle-class folks bail out because they can't afford the volatility, which makes it hard to sleep at night, says finance professor Joseph Bonaparte at the University of Colorado, Denver. His example is himself.
In March, when the market was falling apart, I had to go in a different bed and sleep. At 2 o'clock, I wake up sweating and cold. Stock market volatility, it's not easy.
At times, a bull market can help everyone. Companies make money and create jobs. But in this pandemic, many lower income earners, say in retail, can't go into work because it's closed, while higher salary workers work from home and keep investing, says Joseph Minerick. He's economist at the Committee on Economic Development of the Conference Board.
At this moment, there's a substantial dissonance and a painful dissonance between what's going on in the stock market and what's going on Main Street.
By the way, in the last 30 years, the stock market has grown faster than the economy. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
You live in Los Angeles or someplace meteorologically similar. Nice weather, lots of outdoor living. Eating outside is kind of a way of life, and restaurants pretty much have it down. In New York, different thing. Serving outside can be a big and expensive pivot, especially in places where outdoor space is limited. Sidewalks and parking lanes have their limits, you know. And also, nobody wants a side of truck exhaust with their meal. But right now, outdoor dining and takeout are the only options, so thousands of New York restaurants are giving it a go. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab checked in with two of them to see how it's going.
Walk down Franklin Avenue in Brooklyn at night, and in some ways, the new normal doesn't look quite so bad. Franklin is like one big, socially distanced outdoor dining party, with tables spilling onto the sidewalk and into the street. The sounds and smells of different restaurants bleed together. There's Mexican, Caribbean, Ethiopian. Chris Kalamchi and Lincoln Wheeler are at a table outside Ra's plant-based Ethiopian.
Yes, we just ordered, and we got
tips with injera, and then we ordered, what was the other one? Some tofu dish with injera?
And avocado salad and some sambusa.
They're celebrating. Their friend who didn't want to talk just got a pandemic puppy. And after 4 months of not being able to eat out, Kalamchi says street dining feels good.
Thought it actually felt a little bizarre the first time, but now it sort of just feels normal. Like walking around and seeing everyone outside eating feels very like a very European vibe that I think is pretty refreshing for New York.
A lot of time and money went into creating that vibe. Romeo Regali owns the restaurant with his wife, Milka. Ultimately, they sank $5,000 into that outdoor space. And it's tiny. Just 6 tables in a parallel parking spot on the street, with a few more on the sidewalk.
The day they announced that, you know, outdoor dining was allowed, I went online and I applied. We got approved right away, and then I just ran to Home Depot.
For Regali, it would be the first of many trips. That one was for plants.
30, 31, 32, 34, I believe I counted right. We wanted to make it look tropical.
Tropical, to help diners forget they're eating just inches away from honking cars and idling delivery trucks. Then there was the trip for cinder blocks, to keep those cars and trucks where they belong. Then another trip for wood fencing. The city inspected Regali's parking spot patio 3 times, and each time he had to shut it down and make adjustments.
Feels like the rules are always changing. It's just every day there's something new. I'm tired of Home Depot. It's just a lot.
But with takeout as the only other option, every square foot counts. And for many restaurant owners, that comes down to luck. Narrow storefront, narrow patio. Fire hydrants, bus stops, and subway grates, forget about it. Corner location, nice. A few blocks away from Regali's restaurant is Oxalis, a French-American restaurant with a Michelin star. Oxalis is known for its $70 6-course meal. Or it was. Steve Wong is the director of operations.
6 courses, servers at the table, talking with the guests, clearing the plates that had been eaten on. 6 times a guest seemed like a lot of contact.
Also, Oxalis's patio is pretty far from the kitchen, with steps and uneven pavement along the way. And during that long walk, food gets cold, or doesn't stay cold. So now, the raw yellowfin tuna comes with the tomato dashi water on the side, in a bottle, on ice. Don't know what tomato dashi water is? No worries, I had to ask too.
You salt tomatoes down, let the water drain out, and then you infuse it with kombu and bonito. So the guests pour the tomato water onto the fish, and it kind of keeps the dish cool while they eat it.
Properly chilled tomato water isn't Wong's only challenge. The dining area is in what was a vacant lot behind the restaurant. Wong's team cleared out the trash and added twinkly lights and white fencing to glam up the space. But beyond that,
it's not very easy to control the elements. You know, everything from the heat to pests, you know, mosquitoes around. Like, bug spray and fine dining do not go together.
Maybe not, but customers don't seem to mind. And for now, outdoor dining is helping the business break even. That is, on a good day. Oxalis had to close early that evening, a peak night, Friday, at a peak hour, 8 p.m. Because even after you control the food and the space and the bugs, one thing you can't control is rain. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, for one brief shining moment this morning, all was right with the world. Zoom was down. Yes, no, I know. School is just getting going in a lot of places. It was disruptive. Classes and meetings were disrupted. Time and energy was spent trying to figure out what went wrong. And then after a couple hours, everything came back up anyway. But come on. Glorious while it lasted, right? All right, we're going, but here with your Monday moment of economic context. Think about this the next time you buy something, next time you buy almost anything, actually. Saw this in the Wall Street Journal today. In the second quarter, just 6 companies accounted for almost 30% of all retail sales. 6 companies, a third of all retail. Any guesses? Yeah, so Walmart and Amazon are the easy ones. Target, Costco, and then Home Depot and Lowe's. So there you go. Our daily production team is Andy Corbin, Ali Pham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Bennett Purser. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.